ॐ सहना भवतु, सहनौ भुनक्तु, सह वीर्यं करवावहै, तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै। ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः। So let's look at this journey that we've been on. We've looked at our pursuits now in terms of artha and kama, in terms of the purusharthas. These are not illegitimate pursuits. This is a description of what it is we find ourselves seeking. And they're not illegitimate because what we're seeking is purnatvam in everything we seek. We're seeking that fullness. It's just that those experiences of desirable objects, desirable experiences, wealth, security, I seek those because I feel insecure. I feel unhappy because we have a conclusion about ourselves. But that pursuit of purnatvam, atmanastu kamaya sarvam priyam bhavati, everything we go towards, we're actually looking for that that hit. It's like every experience is like a mirror that's programmed to dissolve in time. We have a happy experience. We go and listen to some music, and that as though reflects my purnatvam, my completeness, and then it just dissolves. It just disappears, and that's gone. And so I need to go for another way. I need to look for another one. I need to look for another avenue. But we're always seeking. We're always seeking. We can't stop seeking that because we don't feel comfortable without being happy, without feeling secure. And so we look for all these ways. We crave that purnatvam. And then those are the first two purusharthas. And the third purusharth we talked about was dharma. Dharma is the pursuit, one way to look at it, is the pursuit of heaven. Punya. Punya means merit, the merit that will get us to a better afterlife and a better birth after this. And it's also living in accordance with the order. The world is an expression of order. And, we haven't talked about this much yet, but it's actually an expression of Ishvara, expression of Bhagavan. And that order is an expression of the Lord. So when we act in accordance with Dharma, in other words, when our actions are harmonious with what is presented to us in a way that is non-injurious and helpful to the world, then we're actually acting in a prayerful way. Every action is a puja. Ahimsa paramo dharma. Ahimsa is seen to be the highest dharma, which means that we don't objectify somebody, we don't use somebody else for our own welfare, because the drishtapala, the immediate result, is that if we have a conscience, we feel remorse for doing things that are hurtful to other people. And it can be hurtful in many ways. It can be hurtful in a physical way. There's the physical aspect of that. There's the emotional aspect. When we act hurtfully towards other, we get what's called papam. And that drishtapala is that struggle with our conscience, because we're not manifesting action that's in tune with our conscience. And so that actually hurts us, and it hurts the other person, and you gain papam. So you're not setting yourself up for a better excursion. You're not setting yourself up for a good vacation up in heaven. You're not setting yourself up for a better life. We talked a bit about the vaktapas, right? That's one way to manifest ahimsa. Vaktapas in Gita, Krishna talks about the speech should be satyam, hitam, and priyam. It should be truthful, and it should be beneficial, and it should be sweet. We can tell somebody something truthful, but if it's not beneficial, why do it? And then even if it might be beneficial, if it's injurious to them in any way, why do that? And that discipline of speech really blesses us as well. And it manifests ahimsa. These three purusharthas, artha, they're usually presented as dharma, artha, kama. Dharma, artha, and kama. They don't solve the fundamental problem. So when we see that either through grace, through a time of distress, through quiet moments of contemplation, through just having enough experience that we see that, you know, so we've done all these things. None of them really seem to be giving us what they are advertised to give us. Then we start looking at moksha. And a mumukshu is one who desires moksha. And moksha is addressing that fundamental problem. A mumukshu, one who desires moksha, is one who wants to address the fundamental universal human problem at its root. Not through all these peripheral ways, not through all these circuitous ways, but basically at the root cause. And so how do we gain that moksha? And how does the wave gain the water? And so we said, do we get it through belief? Do we get it through experience? Do we get it through knowledge? Does the water need to purify itself? Does it need to get more water, etc.? Does it need to transform itself? You know, does it need to stop its little wave thoughts? Right? So, you know, let's say the ripples on the wave are its thoughts, and the wave will think, if I can just get rid of these little ripples or the foam, let's say the foam are the thoughts, does getting rid of the foam, the foam thoughts, does that make the wave more watery? It doesn't, because in fact, and so this become more clear as we proceed, in fact, the thoughts, the foam on the water is itself no different than water. It is water. The foam on the wave is water. It's not other than water. Our thoughts that manifest in our minds are no other than consciousness. We don't need to get rid of the foam to see the water. The foam itself is water. We don't need to get rid of thoughts. Thoughts themselves are consciousness. So there's nothing we can do. There's nothing we can believe. There's nothing we need to experience. So what is it, right? So we look at it and we say, we need to know. We need to remove, the wave needs to remove the ignorance that it is water. And so how do we do this? How do you gain something that's already there, right? If you want to gain something that's not here, it's called apraptasya praptihi. Praptihi means the acquisition of the aprapta, of something that we don't have yet. So let's say we want a ring. And if it's just a simple ring, that might be a simple matter. If we want a wedding ring, that may require a lot more effort, a lot more subtlety. But let's say we just want a ring. So we can choose to go to the store and get a ring. We can choose not to get a ring. We can choose to get a bracelet. All of those are choices because action is called purusha tantra. It's dependent on the will of the person. You can choose to do it, kartum shakyam. You can choose to not do it, akartum shakyam. You can choose to do it differently, anyata kartum shakyam. And it's dependent on the will of the individual to go and get something which is not already present. The success that we have of getting those things is dependent on our knowledge, dependent on our effort, and it dependent on grace, on daivam. We can know everything that we need to know about climbing Mount Everest, about summiting Mount Everest, right? We can have all the equipment. We can have all the knowledge. We can have all the skill. But there's that unknown factor that always comes into play, that daivam. That's why, you know, the shantis we do, om shanti, shanti, shantihi, one of those is for adi bhautika, adi daivika, and adhyatmika. Those are to get rid of the three obstacles that are prevent us from any success, having to do with ourselves, having to do with the nature, and having to do with just our punya and papam, with grace, with our destiny. You know, may all those obstacles be removed. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. So our limit, our actions are limited because our knowledge is limited, our skill is limited, and we have no control over millions of variables that will affect whether we're successful or not. That's what's involved in gaining something that's not already there, right? That's what we usually think of when we want to gain something, right? Why do we want to gain something that's there? We want to gain something that's already there if it's covered by ignorance. So that's called praptisya-prapti. It's a unique form of endeavor. We want to get what's already there. Look at this. How do I gain my glasses? I put my glasses on top of my head. How do I gain my glasses? I want to become the person who has glasses. I am seeking the person who has glasses. The problem is that the sadhaka, the seeker, and the sadhya, the person who has the glasses, are one and the same. So what do I need to do to gain my glasses? I need to know that I am one who already possesses glasses, right? And so what does that mean? I need to remove the ignorance that I am one who possesses glasses. Atmavit shokam tarati, tarati shokam apnavit, Chandogya Upanishad. The one who knows the self solves this fundamental problem. What that does is very critical, recognizing that first what we're seeking is moksha in everything we look at, that craving for the punaritvam. Everything we go after is seeking that freedom, is seeking myself. We become mumukshus. Now, if we take a close look, because there's no other way to gain this, and because the Shastra says you already are that, what's keeping you from being, what's keeping the wave from being water is ignorance. So now we become jignyasus. We were bubukshus originally, people who wanted distraction and novelty to try to solve the problem. And then we become mumukshus, the one who desires moksha, one who desires to solve the problem at a fundamental level. And then we become jignyasus because we realize what the sadhana is. The sadhana is the removal of ignorance of the nature of myself. So jignyasuhu is one who desires knowledge. Why would I desire knowledge? I desire knowledge because I desire moksha. And why do I desire moksha? It's because I see that the avenues I've been trying so far have not really been successful. And I have a spiritual vision now that I want to solve this problem. So we want to look at, well, how do you remove ignorance? How do we remove ignorance in the world right now? How do I remove ignorance of what an apple tastes like? I remove ignorance of what an apple tastes like by tasting an apple. How do I remove ignorance of what a rose smells like? By smelling it. How do I remove ignorance of what the sunset looks like? I see it. How do I remove ignorance of what a particular song is, a particular raga? I hear it, right? The softness of a pillow, I touch it. This is how we view the world. It's as if the world is filled with touchable things and smellable things and hearable things and seeable things. These are our five senses. These five senses, this capacity, this perceptual capacity in Sanskrit is called pratyaksha. There's five senses. There's the ears, there's the skin, there's the eyes, there's the tongue, and there's the nose. And the things that we perceive in this world are shabda, sounds, sparsha, touchable things, textures, rupa, form and color, rasa, flavor, and gandha. Fragrance. And you know, our capacities are to do this, we differ among people. You know, as we get older, some of these senses sort of diminish a bit. Some critters have excellent hearing, have excellent smell, have not so great sight, right? A dog, for example, you know, like we talked about, hear things that we can't hear. A cat doesn't actually see very well at daytime. Its peripheral vision is very good though, and it sees very well at night, different than us. These jnanindriyani, it's called. Jnana means knowledge. Indriya means a sense capacity. These are the pancha jnanindriyani. These are the five sense capacities, and they're common to almost everyone. Some of us don't have some of those sense capacities. So can I know myself through the sense of, through any of the senses? Can I feel myself? Can I see myself? Can I hear myself? Right? What I can know about myself through the capacity of the senses is just this body. I can hear the body, right? When I touch it, when I make some noise, shabda, sparsha, I can feel this body. I can feel this body. And the funny thing is that the body can be both the subject and the object at the same time. When I do namaskaram, when I do this, am I the right hand touching, objectifying the left palm? Or am I the left palm objectifying and touching the right palm? I'm both, right? I'm both. If I'm the sense of touch here, I'm objectifying the sense of touch here, and vice versa. And this sense of touch is unique because it permeates the entire body. The whole body is permeated by the sense of touch, both internally and externally. It's one reason why I have such a strong association with it, because we feel it, and we feel it all the time. And it's sometimes it's pleasurable, sometimes unfortunately it's painful, but it gives us a very strong identity with this body. So we can hear the body, we can touch the body, we can see the body. We know its attributes. We know if it's tall, short, fat, skinny, green, blue. We know its form, we know its color. I can taste the body if I wanted to. I could lick my finger. And sometimes I can smell the body, unfortunately, if you don't smell like a rose. So we can objectify ourselves through our senses if what I mean by ourselves is the body. Now, the thing is that anything that I can objectify is not me. We'll go into this a lot more later. But really, there's always a subject-object relationship in any cognition. In almost every form of knowledge, there's the knower and there's the known. And the known is different than the knower. I know my body. How do I know my body? I know my body through my senses. And so because I have a subject-object relationship with this body, I am, by definition, not this body. I have a subject-object relationship with any object of my cognition. I'm not that chair. I'm not that table. I'm not that body. I'm not this body. I'm totally aware of this body. This body can't exist without me. This body is very useful. I have a certain relationship with this body. You know, I have a capacity. You know, when I want to pick up an apple, I have to pick up an apple like this and then drop it. When I want to pick up my hand, I don't need to pick up my hand like this, right? I don't need to pick this up and then drop it. I can just go rise and it rises all by itself. So we have a unique relationship with this body, but from a knowledge perspective, which is a very real and important perspective to thoroughly understand, this body is an object of my cognition. And whatever I objectify, I am the perceiver of the perceived. This body is perceived through the five senses. Anything that's perceived through the five senses is not the perceiver, including this body, including that table, including that chair, including this body. There's a lot more to say about that. But I cannot, the degree to which I can know myself through my senses is just that much. I can know this body. What's another way that we know things? Another way that we know things is through inference. Anumana is called. Anu means after. Mana means knowing. Anumana means inference, right? We talked about that. How do I know there's fire up on the mountain? Inference is based on pratyaksha, based on perception, because I have to see the smoke. I've seen the relationship between fire and smoke. I see the smoke, and therefore I know that there's fire. Now, do I have a direct perception of fire? Is it aparoksha? Is it direct or indirect? Is it paroksha or aparoksha of fire? It's indirect, because I don't directly perceive it, I infer it. So inference gives you what people might say an intellectual knowledge, right? As if there's nasal knowledge, Swamiji says. You only know with your buddhi, you only know with your mind. That's how you know something. the mind has to be behind the senses. Sometimes people think that the senses are a bad thing, these five senses. They're not. They're just input devices. There's nothing right or wrong about input devices. It's what you do with that information. So inference is not direct. Pratyaksha is direct. Perception is direct. Inference is indirect. These are two of the main forms of pramanas, they're called. There's six total. Some of these other ones are very interesting. We won't go into too much detail about this. But one is called artapati. It is presumption. It is postulate. It is how you know this. Let's say you go out in the morning and you see that the ground is completely covered with water. It's completely wet. It's not raining now. You know the sprinklers didn't go on. The streets, everything, the car, everything is covered with water. What can you know from that? You know that it must have rained. That's not the same thing as inference. Let's say Devadatta. You might get to know a fellow named Devadatta. Devadatta is just a fellow's name. Let's say Devadatta is a portly fellow. He's very stout. He's a large, round man. But you never see him eating. You're with him all day, and you never see him eating. You have to conclude that he eats at night. That is considered a unique pramana, a unique way of knowing, because there's no other explanation. It's not an inference. It's not a logistical syllogism. You know, it's not like Aristotle is a man, all men are mortal, therefore Aristotle is mortal. There's no such syllogism there. So it's considered a unique form of knowledge, a unique pramana, a unique means of knowledge. Another one is called upamana. It is by example, by knowing the attributes of one thing, you know the attributes, and therefore you know the other thing. The typical example is, there's apparently, I don't know if you would ever find these in the mountains near the Gurukulam in Anakati, but apparently there's a wild cow called the Gavayava, or there was. And a forester, let's say a forest ranger, comes up to a farmer and says, "Have you ever seen a Gavayava?" The farmer says, "No, I've never seen a Gavayava." Forest ranger says, "Oh, it's just like, it looks like a cow. It has this, it kind of looks like a cow in this respect. It kind of looks like a cow in this respect." So if you see a wild animal out there that's not a cow, but that looks like a cow, that's a Gavayava. And so the farmer goes out into the forest and he sees this critter, and it looks kind of like a cow. It's not a cow, but it has the same attributes of it. And he goes, "Ah, that must be a Gavayava." Right? If it walks like a duck, and it quacks like a duck, and it sounds like a duck, you know, if it looks like a duck, it's probably a duck. So the same thing, that's considered upamana. You're looking at something, you gain knowledge of one thing by comparing it to something else, and you know the attributes of that something else, and so you know this first thing. The fifth one, penultimately, is anupalabdhi. Upalabdhi means cognition. Anupalabdhi means non-cognition. How do I know I don't have an elephant on the palm of my hand? How do I know I don't have an elephant on the palm of my hand? I don't perceive the absence of an elephant. You cannot perceive the absence of something. You can only perceive something that exists. You can't perceive something that doesn't exist. So your eyes cannot see the absence of that. It's not an inference. You have to go on forever inferring, okay, I infer there's not a cow on the palm of my hand. I infer that there's not a duck. There's not an elephant. There's not a radish, you know. It's not. So, curiously, anupalabdhi, how do you account for the non-perception of something? You account for the non-perception of something through anupalabdhi. Kind of fun. Epistemology. Epistemology is how do you know something? Episteme means knowledge. Logos means knowledge. The knowledge of how you know something. The investigation on how you know something. So these are five pramanas, but there's one more that we haven't talked about yet. And this is critical. It's called shabda pramana. Shabda just means sound, but here it means word. You can gain knowledge through words. And when we think of shabda pramana, we think it gives us indirect knowledge. And this is actually how most of our knowledge kind of takes place. When we're, you know, how do we know that water is made of H2O? Have I ever seen two little hydrogen atoms and one oxygen atom to make a water molecule? No, I haven't perceived that. Have I inferred it? No, not personally. How did I know that water is H2O? I knew it because an Aptapurusha means somebody whom you trust, a knowledgeable person, has told you that there is water, and water is made of molecules, and water molecules are made of two hydrogen and one oxygen atom. And so that's an indirect piece of knowledge. We know that through someone telling us. Most of our book learning, as we say, most of our book learning is we have faith in the textbooks. That's why some of these controversies about what are put in textbooks and what we teach, because we have to trust that source. Most of us trust science, that science is has a valid methodology for discovering what's there within the scope of that. But science is based on perception. We have these capacities to see things, and then we augment our senses through instruments. So we have a telescope, we have a radio telescope, we have a microscope, we have an electron microscope, right? We take these capacities we have and we enhance them through instrumentation. Based on observation, we can make hypotheses, and then we can test those hypotheses, or we can make inferences based on what we perceive. And then we can go in front of a classroom and tell these elementary school kids, when do you learn that water is H2O? You can tell these children that water is really H2O. There are all these little molecules here. So we usually think as indirect knowledge. And so when we think, okay, well, what we want is tattva bodha. We want knowledge of the truth. We want knowledge of reality. We want knowledge of ourselves, right? What good is hypothetical, intellectual, theoretical knowledge of myself? That's not going to solve my hunger. If I'm hungry, I don't need to read the cookbook. I need to go and do something and make that food and appease my hunger, right? Yeah, that makes sense, doesn't it? So how does the words in the Shastra or the words of the teacher, how does that give you direct knowledge? So we saw that when we want to gain something that we don't already have, we have to go do something. Apraptasyaprapti. If we want to gain something that we already have, we need to remove the ignorance about that. If that thing is remote, then I can only gain indirect knowledge. That molecule of water is not directly perceivable by me in my current state with these glasses that I have on. If the ignorance is regard to something that is immediately available, then words can produce direct knowledge. If the object of that pramana, if the goal of that pramana is to reveal something which is distant from us in time and space, then when it reveals that, it's indirect. If that thing which the pramana reveals is not distant in time or space, but is here to be revealed, then words can reveal that object. So let me tell you a story. These 10 boys were sent by their guru to go to a different school about 10 miles away down the path to go visit. He sends them off in the morning. They're, I don't know, young teenagers, 14, 15 years old. And so they all go. They set out early in the morning. They have their packs of food, and they go out to go to this other village. What was once a stream turns out to be a river. And that river is bigger than they had thought it was going to be. That river it's not just ankle deep. It is now up to their chest. So they have to take their bags and they have to put it over their heads, and they have to walk across the river, ford the river, ford the stream. And it's kind of tough going. You know, the water's slippery and it's cold, and they go across, and wow, that was more of an effort than they thought it was going to be. And they wanted to make sure. There's one leader who thought, okay, well, let's make sure we all made it across okay. I kind of lost track. I was so involved in me getting across that I didn't pay attention to anybody else. So he started counting. He started counting everybody. He counted 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Wait. Let me do that again. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. There's only 9 of us here. And so he asks somebody else to count. Surya. He says, Surya, count. I only find 9. How many do you find? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Okay, Fred. It's a very mixed group. Fred, you go. You count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. So then they start getting worried. It's like, oh, well, we started with 10. I know that. I know there was a 10th guy here. And now there's only 9 of us. So they start getting really worried. They start getting all this anxiety. One of them, the leader, says, oh, maybe I should go back to the other. Maybe he ran ahead. Maybe he got swept downstream. So they start fanning out, looking downstream, looking upstream. They look across the river. They don't see him. They shout his name. Where are you? Where are you? They can't find him anywhere. This 10th man is nowhere to be found. There's such despair. What are they going to tell their teacher? They lost one of them? Oh, well, you didn't really need, he wasn't that good of a student anyway. You didn't really need him in your classroom. He was kind of disruptive and, you know. And so they're in tears. They don't know what to do. This old man, this pilgrim, this wise old man comes. He's been watching them for a while, kind of scratching his head. And he approaches them and says, what is your problem? Why are you so distraught? What's wrong? The leader says, we were 10, and now we're only 9. We crossed the river, and now one of us is lost. One of us is gone. What are we going to do? This is horrible. And the man assesses the situation, this pilgrim, this old man assesses the situation. And he says, Ashochanan Vashochastvam. Right? The first line of the teaching of Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita. Ashochan Unvashochastvam. Tvam, you are grieving for no reason at all. Those who are don't deserve grief. There's no reason. You're completely misunderstanding the situation. And so the leader says, what do you mean? So this fellow, this wise man, there is no reason for them to disbelieve, right? He had no interest in fooling them about this. In fact, the pilgrim, the wise man said, you know, I can show you this 10th man right now. I can show you this 10th person right now. And so he kind of calmed down. He said, oh, there is a solution? There's not a problem? What do you mean? So he's terribly confused. He wants freedom. He wants moksha from this anxiety, from this situation. He wants out. He wants to solve this problem. His looking for that 10th man is very valid. It's not an invalid search, but he was looking in all the wrong places. He was looking downstream. He's looking upstream. He's looking everywhere, and there's nowhere to be found. And yet this indirect knowledge that this pilgrim, wise man gives him some relief. Like the Shastra saying, Atmavit Shokam Tarati, Tarati Shokam Apnavit. There is a solution to your problem. Really? Yes, there's a solution to your problem. So he gains this somewhat equipoised mind. He says, okay, well, he kind of wipes his tears away and he says, okay, the wise man has all the boys line up. He puts the boy next to him, the leader, and he says, now count out each of these. Count out each of the boys. The leader counts out 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. The leader looks at this wise pilgrim and says, there are only 9 of us. And the wise man looks at him and says, Tattvamasi, you are the 10th man. Dashamaha asi, tvam, you are the 10th person. And all of a sudden, The boy realized there really was no problem. There really was no problem. I had faith in this teacher. I had faith in this guru. I had faith in this wise man who didn't ask me to do anything. He didn't ask me to believe anything. He didn't ask me to experience anything. And now the problem is solved. What a problem. This is praptasya praptihi. This is the acquisition of the already acquired. What did the wise man ask the boy to do? He didn't say, you have to believe much harder. Just believe. Believe the 10th man is there. Believe the 10th man is there. Just close your eyes and believe the 10th man is there. If he had asked the boy to just close your eyes, everybody, just close your eyes and believe, chances are he would have walked around, taken all the boy's possessions and run away. Close your eyes and believe. Give me money and I will solve your problem. Oh, by the way, you just have to believe. You have to believe because there's no way to validate it. The 10th man didn't need to experience his 10thness. In fact, the 10th man could not have made a mistake about the situation unless he knew two things. Unless he knew that there was a 10th man, there were supposed to be 10 boys, and he knew that there were 10 people who started off the journey. So he knew there was supposed to be a 10th man. And he knew that he existed. He knew that he was there. He could give you his whole biography. He could tell you where he was born. He could tell you his sister's name, his mother's name, his lineage, his gotra, his rishi, right? His sutra. He can tell you all of that. But he couldn't tell you that he was the 10th man. What he had was called samanya jnanam. Jnanam means knowledge. Samanya means a general knowledge. And that's what we have. Especially if we're mumukshus, especially if we're jignasus. Everybody knows that they exist. Everybody knows. Not everybody knows that the problem is me, the solution is me. If you know that the solution is based on one's self-conclusion, then you are a mumukshu, you are one who wants moksha. And so you know that there is a solution, you know that there is a 10th person, you know that there is something, and your guru comes to you, a guru will come to you and say, you know, don't worry, just calm down, just calm down a little bit. In fact, he may give you some exercises, right? Yeah, the guru has to do two things. This wise person had to do two things. He had to calm the boy down so he could see the reality of the situation. And he had to create the context by which the boy had no choice but to see the truth of what the situation was, the truth, the reality. So that the teacher gives you practices. He could say, okay, now just take a deep breath, just relax. You know, wipe those tears, stop crying. You know, he could have patted the shoulder saying, it's okay, don't worry, calm down, take a deep breath. Here, have a sip of water. The guru will say, here, do this pranayama, do these meditation exercises. Here, do these yogasanas. Calm down a little bit, calm the mind so you can see what's going on. Do this puja so your heart opens up. Do this karma yoga, so that your ragas and dveshas, your likes or dislikes, are not pulling you in every single direction, so you're not frenzied. Do these so you're yukta, you're a yogi, so that you are self-possessed. A yogi is one whose cravings for things, whose ragas and dveshas, whose likes and dislikes, whose passion to pursue things and passions to get rid of things, have merely become preferences. That's the goal of karma yoga. We'll talk all about that. That's part of half of the Gita, more than half the Gita. The Bhagavad Gita are two books in one, right? It's considered almost like an Upanishad. Upanishatsu, Brahma Vidya Yam, Upanishatsu. That's at the end of each chapter, that's what you chant. Upanishatsu, it's like an Upanishad because it gives you this tattva bodha, it gives you this knowledge of the truth. And it's a yoga shastra. In this dialogue between Arjuna and Krishna, and this yoga are these techniques or these practices, basically karma yoga, which can also be doing dharma, doing puja, singing bhajans, doing asanas, doing pranayama, doing meditation, doing all these, giving, doing charity, helping other people. All of these are practices by which you can calm down, gain objectivity towards the world, towards the situation, so that your mind is prepared for this vision. The pilgrim, the holy man, the teacher who said, Tattvamasi, you are the solution, you are that tenth man, he calmed the boy down first. So calm down, take a breath, have a drink of water, do this, prepare yourself. And then, once he was had a little self, he was self-possessed, he made him systematically count out those other nine boys. And we'll understand that much more after we get into Tattvabodha, because the very first part is understanding what I am not. Neti, 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 neti. Na iti, na iti, na iti. I am not that. I am not that. I am not that. What am I? So when you clearly see what you are not, you know, like in today's meditation, the body sits in awareness. I am completely aware of the body. And we looked at pratyaksha, at perception. I am completely knowledgeable about the body to the degree that I can perceive it with my senses. I don't have a clue how it works. You know, I don't know. The first thing about biology, you know, there's a, how does the heart work again? But it's an object of my cognition. So that's one of the first step of a process called a prakriya, a teaching methodology, a method of inquiry called drikdrisha vivekaha, the inquiry into the difference between the discriminative analysis, the viveka, between the drik and the drisha, between the seer and the seen. And the very first step of that is naham dehaha. Well, the first step is I am not anything out in this world, and this body actually belongs in the world. It's a part of the world. If this object here, this hand, is as much part of the world as anything else, right? In our vision, we can relegate this body to being another object in the world. It totally depends on me, but it depends on me. It is me. This body is me, but I am not this. I am not this body. I am not limited by this body. This body is my vehicle that I walk around in. So this neti, 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 this 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. That's the guru, that's the teacher creating the context by which one is forced to understand. One has no choice but to understand that he or she is the 10th man, 10th woman, if you will. And that's the sampradaya, that's the teaching methodology. It's an amazing thing. That's why the name of the San Diego effort to bring this teaching here is called Arsha Drishti. Pooja Swamiji, his Gurukulams are called Arsha Vidya, the knowledge of Arsha. Arsha is a tadita, it's a derivative noun from the noun Rishi. Rishi are the seers of the Vedas, they're the one through whom this teaching has come. And Arsha is an adjectival form, it means that which comes from the Rishis. What comes from the Rishis? The Vedas come from the Rishis. Arsha Vidya is the knowledge of what comes from the Rishis, which is the Veda. Arsha Drishti, Drishti means vision. Drishti means vision. The vision of the Rishis. What's the vision of the Rishis? The vision of the Rishis is Tattvamasi. The Upanishads say you are that solution. You are the most obvious thing in the world. The solution is the most obvious thing in the world, but it's very well hidden. It's hidden in plain sight. It's hidden in plain sight. We'll talk about that in just a second. So this Arsha Drishti is the vision of the Rishis. And how does one gain the vision of the Rishis? The Guru's vision is not different from the vision of the Rishis. If the Guru is both a Shrotriya and a Brahmanishta, is one who knows the teaching tradition, and who he himself sees that, yes, I am the truth of this entire creation. I am the only reality here. I am the only vastu. I am the only thing. Everything else depends on me. It is just incidental. Everything fundamentally is me based on who I now see myself to be. I'm not lacking in anything. I'm not bound by time. I'm not bound by space. I'm not craving anything because I am the source of all purnatvam. If that's the vision of the guru, And if that guru has the sampradaya and the parampara, is part of the parampara, and has the traditional teaching methodology, the sampradaya, by which he can create a situation wherein the student has no choice but to see, but to know, but to understand, then that guru's drishti, the guru drishti, the vision of the guru, which is the Veda drishti, is the Arsha drishti, becomes the Shishya drishti. The student's vision of himself becomes no different. There's what technically is a Khandakara vritti. It's when the teacher can create the same vritti in your mind as he has in his mind, which was created by his teacher and created by his teacher, and which is no different than the vision of the completeness that is told in the Upanishads. That is the Arsha Drishti, and that is the Shabda Pramana that is at work. And it's not indirect, because there's nothing here but me to see. That tenth man was not distant. That tenth man had no choice but to see the truth of what that teacher was saying. It's not indirect. It's not inferential. Here's words do not give inferential knowledge, does not give intellectual knowledge, does not give paroksha jnana, does not give indirect knowledge, because I am here for me to see. And that's what's so beautiful about this tradition, is that it's a living teaching tradition wherein you see the reality of what is, and that Arsha Drishti, which is the Guru Drishti, that vision, that drishti, that is in the Vedas, in the Upanishads, in the Bhagavad Gita, is the same vision that the teacher has. That's why when you find a real teacher, that teacher looks at you with this drishti, with this vision. He doesn't see this limited person. He can't but see, you know, the samsari when someone comes to him and they're in pain or they're in turmoil or they're searching, right? He sees all that. None of that disappears, but the truth of what the teacher sees in you is that he sees somebody with no problem. It's like this tenth man. It's like this in the tenth man. It's like this wise pilgrim coming to the boy, and he had this little smile on his face. It's like Krishna has this little smile on his face when he's talking to Arjuna. He says, "Ashochanam vashochaswam, you don't have a problem. The problem you think you have, you don't have in the least." That man had to kind of, you know, the pilgrim had to maintain his composure because he saw the joke in the situation. In the end, it's laughable. In the end, there was no problem to begin with. That is that pilgrim's drishti, that there was no problem, and that that tenth boy was always there, was never lost. That wave is always the water. That water was never lost. Right? The water didn't need to do anything, didn't need to believe anything, didn't need to transform himself, didn't need to experience anything. That boy didn't need to transform himself into the tenth man. He didn't need to believe that he was a tenth man. He didn't need to go and search somewhere, you know? Maybe you do need to do a little of that, though. You know, maybe you need to search and find these dead ends and say, well, that I think that works, but it didn't quite, and that sort of works, and that doesn't quite, but that nothing quite worked. Help me. You know, it's like you finally give up and you go, help me, give me an answer. That's the beginning of mumukshutvam, when you actually surrender to Bhagavan and say, I don't have the answers. That's why suffering can be grace. That's why when you reach the end of your tether, the end of your rope, and you say, I don't have the answers, what is there? That's when your guru comes. That's when your teacher comes. It's absolutely amazing. So why are you so hidden? Why is that tenth man so hidden? The best place to hide something is the place where you've already concluded it's no way it can be there. That tenth man has already, he hasn't made a logical syllogism about it, but he has concluded that it didn't even occur to him that he was the solution. He didn't even occur to them that he was the problem. The problem was out here. The problem was all this. It didn't occur to him. That's the best place to hide something, is where you'd never think of looking at it for it. You'd never think because the minute you start seeking, the minute you seek something, even in the slightest bit, what you're doing is denying the presence of the sought. The minute you start seeking, even in the slightest, you're denying the presence of the sought. And then you're off. You're off at the races. You're off. You're off looking downstream. You're off looking upstream. You're diving underneath the water to try to find the solution. It will never occur to us that I am the solution to my problem, and it will never occur to us that the drishti of my complete fullness, my complete wholeness, is no different than what I am right now. It's just that I have concluded that I am less. I am not. This boy had samanya jnanam. He had this general knowledge that he existed. He knew that the tenth man existed. He is lacking what is called vishesha jnanam. Vishesha jnanam. These two words may sound a little familiar. Last week we talked about samanya dharma and vishesha dharma. Samanya dharma means a general dharma. Vishesha dharma is the dharma you apply to a specific situation. Samanya jnanam is the knowledge, the general knowledge. I have a problem. I'm a limited being. I know that I exist. I know there's a solution because I get a little hit of it. I get a little taste of it every time. I get a little happiness. I get some security. My stock portfolio rises. I feel good. Oh, the stock portfolio dives. Oh, I feel horrible, you know? I go and see a performance. I listen to, you know, this beautiful veena player. You know, it's not just a veena player, but they have a mridangam. Not just a mridangam, but a ghatam and a kanjira and a mursing. You know, they have the whole percussive orchestra, and you're just in bliss. You're just pounding out that aditalam, and it's your mind just resolves, and you have this joyful experience, and then it goes. The concert's over. You're back to your life. You go to your apartment, you go to your house, you go to your life, and then you struggle once again. That mirror of that music, which held up and let you see temporarily, your purnatvam dissolves. It's like looking, if we could ever reach that mirror, that the water of a mirage, you know, it just goes, it just dissolves. But a pramana, which the shastra is, which this teaching is like a mirror that holds a mirror up to you so you cannot but see. You can't help but see the truth of what it tells. And what it sees, what it's reflecting back, is yourself. That pilgrim, that wise man could have, if you wanted to be very, you know, very poetic, perhaps, and very cryptic, he could have taken his mirror out and just held it up to the fellow. Look, the guy maybe would have scratched his head. He still probably wouldn't have gotten it. He says, look, you are the tenth man. Dashaha asi tvam, you, dashamaha, naraha, you are the tenth asi, you are. Tattvamasi, you are that tenth man. So he didn't have specific knowledge of himself. He had general knowledge of himself. And that's what this teaching tradition is. You are the tenth man, the wave. The wave is the water. It's like the guru wave coming and saying, you are water. You are water. You are the tenth man, tattvamasi. We see now that we've gone from bhubhukshus, wanting our fulfillment in transitory tchotchkes. You know, tchotchke, transitory, little, glittery, shiny things. A valid search for purnatvam that always falls short. We've become mumukshus. We want to solve the fundamental problem. We see that there's nothing that can be done. And there's a beautiful, beautiful verse from the Munika that we'll talk about next week as well. Pariksha lokan karma chitan. Brahmano nirveda mayat nasya krita kritena tad vijna nartam sah brahmanah gurum eva abhigachet samit panihi shrotriyam brahmanishtam. We'll talk about that as well next week, because we see that the solution for gaining moksha is knowledge. Because the truth is never distant. All the other pramanas cannot provide this knowledge. Shabda pramana can, because reality, truth, which is myself, is never separate. And so it can reveal the truth of what exists right now. It's not distant. There's nothing to do, there's something to see. Om swasti prajabhyah paripalayantam nyayena margena mahimahishah go brahmanebhyah shubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu parjanyah prithivi sasya shalini desho yamcho barahitah brahmana santu nirbhayah om sarve bhavantu sukhinah sarve santu niramayaha sarve bhadrani pashyantu ma kashchit dukkha bhag bhavet asato ma sadgamaya tamaso ma jyotirgamaya mrityor ma amritangamaya om purnamadah purnamidam purnat purnamudachyate purnasya purnamadaya purnameva vishishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om Om Tat Sat Sarvam Ishvarakum Namastu. We kind of went through those pramanas quickly, but epistemology is fun. But the main things to take away are that, you know, our most common pramanas are Vidyaksha, you know, sensory perception, Anumana, inference, and then Shabda. And the other ones are, you know, some schools of thought have, some accept, five, some accept four. It's kind of interesting. Epistemology is a fascinating, fascinating study.
Dakshaji, okay, question. Yeah, so, I mean, eventually it is the mind that we need to kind of like, a master over, right? That is eventually what is making us feel happy or unhappy. We have transcended a long way from being physical beings where our needs for food and whatever, right? Like clothing, we have gone many, many years past that point. So now we are not living for those basic necessities, right? So at this point, we are, as you said, like our mind is now trying to get happiness, and we are trying to search for happiness in all kinds of like physical objects, which we all know is now, comes and goes. So eventually it is just controlling the mind. Is that something that we will be covering? Is that correct? Or if you don't have, I'll let you finish and then maybe we'll ask a follow up. Yeah.
Okay. So it's the nature of the mind to think. What can be gained by controlling the mind? What's the sadhya? What's the thing to be accomplished by controlling the mind? It is beneficial to have the capacity to have a choice in where the mind goes. If the mind habitually goes out to certain things, you know, if it wants you to go out and get drunk every night, it's beneficial to have the wherewithal to divert the mind and say no. When you're trying to get some work done, it's nice if the mind doesn't wander off to think about carrot cake when you're trying to get some work done. When you sit for meditation, it's beneficial that you can rest the attention on a certain object. Like the object of meditation today was just the sensation of the breath coming in and out of the nostrils. And we can see that there's something called associative thinking that often takes us away. We can think of the nose, right? We have a feeling in the sense of the nose. And then I think I smell something. Oh, I wonder, did I leave a candle burning? Oh, the candle burning. Oh, I wonder, I hope I'm not in danger. If it is, I wonder, did I pay my house insurance? Did I pay my home insurance? You know, I usually pay my home insurance through the online billing system, but sometimes the online billing system doesn't always work. you know, I've heard of all these hackers. I wonder if my bank account has been hacked. I should change the password in my online billing, because if it got hacked, then, oh my goodness. So you can have these stream of thoughts, these associative thinking. One is linked to another, is linked to another, is linked to another. It's beneficial to have the wherewithal, the mastery of the mind, to control that associative thinking, to allow that goes. I mean, you don't want to control it all the time. That's how, sort of how the mind works. You know, creativity is this free form associative thinking sometimes. So we have to understand what mastery of the mind means. We want to be able to have a choice in our ragas and dveshas, right? Our Gita talks all about this, and we can talk about this a lot more, is that ragas are desires and our likes and dislikes. But if they have a hold of us, I have no choice. They have a hold of us. If I have a choice, if they're mere preferences, if I have vairagya, if I have an objectivity towards what those ragas and dveshas are trying to convince me of, then I have some mastery of the mind, the content of the mind. But a mastery of the mind in that sense, having a choice about where the mind will take us. The example of Gita, the Gita Upadesha, is that, you know, there's beautiful imagery of Krishna having the reins of the horse. The horses are the five senses, and the reins are the buddhi, and that whole imagery. That's necessary but not sufficient, because the end game is not mastery of the mind. The end game is understanding that I, who am the sakshi, who am the witness of the mind, the consciousness that informs the mind, every thought, the consciousness that exists, and the existence that is there in every thought, the truth of that is the truth of the Lord, is the truth of you. That knowledge, that direct appreciation of that, that's the end game. That's where the moksha comes. And so the mind can do anything, right? So the Gita has this beautiful vision of emotional maturity, has this beautiful vision of how a sadhaka, how a seeker refines his or her being, as you will, his or her person, who gains emotional maturity, going from tamoguna to rajoguna to sattvaguna, someone who is very base and not very refined, who is attracted to things that aren't beneficial, transforms into one who is very active and is rajasic and goes out and does things, into one who's much more contemplative. So that transformation from one who has qualities which are not conducive to a contemplative, introspective analysis of the nature of the truth of the universe and myself, that can be seen as a mastery of oneself. That can be seen as increasing your emotional intelligence IQ. But in the end, whatever the mind is doing, it does not diminish me, because the mind, just as the body is an object of my cognition, the mind is an object of my cognition. I have a subject-object relationship with my mind. And whether the mind is thinking about the moon or the mind is thinking about dinner, it doesn't really matter, because I am the one who illumines the mind. And I am the very content of the mind. I am the very reality of the mind. I don't need to change what the mind is thinking about, because if the wave knows that he's water, he doesn't need to control how many bubbles show up. He doesn't need to control that, oh, this is all bubbly over here and there's no bubbles over here, right? Sometimes there's bubbles, sometimes there's not bubbles. He knows that he's water. He knows that when someone touches the wave, you're actually touching water. So the truth of the wave is not the jiva. The jiva is the wave. Ishwara is the ocean. Bhagawan, the Lord, is the ocean. There's nothing here but Bhagawan. It's all ocean. But in truth, when I, the jiva, see the truth of myself as water, that's the same water that Bhagawan, that the Lord, points to when he says, I created everything. I'm just this little wave. It doesn't really matter. I don't need to control the particularities of my thought, because when you know the truth of yourself, there's no better place for your mind to reside than in yourself. If you are the source of Purnatvam, if you are Satchit Ananda, if you are existence, this is really jumping the gun here, jumping ahead. But if you are a conscious being, which is no different than the Purnatvam that we seek in everything, then what better place for the mind to reside than there? But it doesn't need to be caught there, because I am never separate from myself, regardless of what thoughts come and go. So the mastery of the mind is useful in gaining knowledge, but knowledge, if the truth of myself is dependent on a state of mind, like the removal of all thoughts, or being able to control thoughts, then when that state goes, the truth of myself goes, and it doesn't. I am present when, and I illumine the mind, I have mastery over. I illumine the mind, which I have no mastery over. The mind does not displace me. The jivatvam, the state of being an individual, does not displace Satchidananda. It doesn't displace me. The wave, the form of the wave, does not displace water, right? It's not like an either-or situation. It's not like I can either be a jiva, you know, a little wave, or I can be the water. No, there's no difference. It's only because the 10th man thought that there was some difference between him and the 10th man that he started to seek and wanted something, like a mastery over the mind. Now, it helped that the 10th man could take a deep breath and have faith in the pilgrim and that wise man so that he could see the truth. He could let the teacher lead him to a point where the vision was inevitable and he saw himself as what he had been seeking. It's useful, but in the end, the 10th man didn't need to master anything. The 10th man just saw what there was to see.
Oh, good.
So I don't know. So does that kind of address?
Right, absolutely, Dakshaji, that was a good thing. Like, especially the last line you said, it was always there, so you don't have to control the mind.
Yes, yeah. And the thing that's really difficult is that we're very goal-oriented and we're very action-oriented. And it's not to say that, you know, like when you go live in a gurukulam, in an ashram, you spend a lot of time doing stuff, right? You get up at 4:30 in the morning, you go to the temple, you do your, you know, you do your puja, you do your asana, you do your study, you do your Sanskrit, you go to classes, you do a whole bunch of stuff. It's not to say that there's nothing to be done if you are a jignyasu. But the answer does not lie in doing, in mastery, in control. The resolution of all struggle comes with the recognition that the sadhya is not different than the sadhaka, that the sadhya is the goal, the thing to be achieved, the purnatvam, is never separate from me, the sadhaka, the seeker, and that the sadhana, the means to gain that purnatvam, is jnanam, is knowledge. And that's why we looked at the pramanas. That's why we looked at all the means of knowledge. And that's why told the 10th man story, is that it's critical to understand that. And that 10th man story will come up again and again because there's so much to it. And if we see it again and again, that the solution is that the 10th man was never away from the 10th man. And that you need to see through the instruction of the guru, through that teacher, that he was, you know, it's kind of a joke. It's a funny situation. He dismissed the reality of what he was looking for in the present and in being right here, and he went everywhere else. Yeah. So that will come up again and again.
That's well put, Dakshaji. Yeah. So, and your things about the iPhone is also a pretty useful comparison, right? The iPhone makes you happy, but it's you who's feeling happy, right? So that means there's some property in you that makes you feel temporarily happy when you see that iPhone or the new gadget.
Yeah, iPhone 6. When is that coming out? I want the iPhone
6. Yeah, iPhone is just a catalyst there. So like, yeah, we just have to understand, yeah, exactly. Like, yeah, that happiness is in ourselves. And yeah, only the external influences are exciting it, and we can find it ourselves. So in other means.
It takes time to see that, right? You know, so this is, we're going to see that in a couple classes, but it's vairagya. We hear about vairagya. You know, someone who has vairagya is one who has no desires, and it's really objectivity. It's really saying things for what they are. A phone is a phone. I can get a little thrill. That's fine. I can get a little thrill because a new iPhone is out and it has now, you know, now I can use, you know, swipe as my keyboard instead of having to poke around on my keyboard or whatever. You know, now it's a 5.5 inch rather than a, you know, 4.8, whatever it was, inch. I can find joy in that, but I can recognize that that joy that I'm feeling has nothing to do with that thing, because it's a sad situation when, if that were really true, if really I had to look for my happiness in Apple Gizmo, you know.
That's right. Thanks, Dakshaji. Yeah.